I'm Dean Murdoch, and this is Amazing Places.
Welcome to another episode of Amazing Places. Today, we're talking about a special issue. We've got a day coming up on March 21st that is the International Day for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. The International Day for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination is observed every year on March 21st as the day that police in Sharpeville, South Africa opened fire and killed 69 people at a peaceful protest against apartheid pass laws in 1960. Since that time, the UN has declared the day and recognized it as a day to be acknowledged around the world. This year's theme for the International Day of Elimination of Racial Discrimination is Youth Standing Up Against Racism. And you can find the hashtag #FightRacism on social media. Today, I reached out to a guest in the Capital Region who we haven't had a chance to check in with yet. I know he was interested in this topic, and I wanted to have a discussion with him about it. It's first-term Victoria City Councillor Sharmarke Dubow. Hi, Sharmarke.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Thank you for joining today. I'm excited for our discussion.
Me too.
Sharmarke, there are probably folks out there who don't know much about you, so I wondered if you could tell us a little bit about yourself and your time on City Council.
My name is Sharmarke Dubow, and actually the story behind my name is my grandmother gave it to me. The meaning comes from the Somali language, the native Somali language. It means the one that sees, you know, evil. And also, she was a big fan of the Somali prime minister at her time, who was also had the name Sharmarke. So I like to believe that she gave me the name because the meaning of it, see no evil, not because of the name of the prime minister, because she wanted this child that was coming to this world that he doesn't see any trouble or evil or danger, all bad things are away from him. So when people say my name, they literally praying for me in my native language. So I was born in Somalia, you know, as I was born in a very humble family. And my mother was not highly educated, but she was very educated. I mean, like in terms of life experience, not in academic. She was a businesswoman. And unfortunately, when I was 6 years old, my parents decided to separate and divorce. So I then, our mother and with my siblings, she raised us as a single mother. And then at the age of 8, then Somalia had a civil war in early 90s, and many Canadians and all the generation will remember how the even Canadian was sent to Somalia in the mid 90s. So I've left and at an early age when I was 8, you know, my family were those families that took the boats through the Indian Ocean to look safe haven in Kenya. And because Somalia has the border with several countries, including in Kenya. So yeah, as young age, I end up in a strange land, you know, taking the risk through the open ocean. And then I end up in a refugee camp in Kenya, where I didn't have the opportunity to go to school. So my childhood has been interrupted and disturbed. And that is the story of all the refugee children as we speak today. You know, the half of the refugees around the world today are children and women. So my story is not unique, and it continues in even today. Then there was uprising in Ethiopia in 2001, student uprising. Then that was again, it really was a reminder of what we ran away from Somalia and the conflict. So my aunt from Seattle, actually, and who knew that I would end up in Victoria at that time, she was living in Egypt. She invited me to join her, but she was American, Seattle resident. So yeah, I joined her family in Egypt. That's where I went to high school. I ended up going to Canadian University, Cape Breton University in Cairo, finished my computer science information technology, then end up working in human rights nonprofit organizations. Then the Arab Spring happened in Egypt in 2011. Then because of the work I was doing on the human rights, it was very risky, and I wasn't a citizen. I was also a refugee in Egypt. So in 2012, I was sponsored to Canada, and I ended up in Winnipeg. Then that led me getting a job in Victoria as a youth worker. Speaking about the theme, my first job in Canada was a youth worker at the Victoria Immigrant Refugee Center Society. Then I've done a lot of work about integration and refugees and migrants and social cohesion and cultural bridging. I worked with ICA, Victoria Intercultural Association Victoria. So I've done a lot of activism, community organizing. Then in 2018, I decided to run for local government. And that was my first ever election. I was eligible because, I was 20 years refugee, so I had no right to vote in any country. And as you know very well, in Canada, you have to be citizen even to vote at local level. So I became citizen in July 1st, the 150 years of Canada. So my first time I had the right to vote is I was running for an office and I got elected. So that's how I end up in Victoria Council as the first term.
What a remarkable story. A city councilor in Victoria, your first opportunity to vote, and you got to vote for yourself. Mm-hmm. I'm curious from your perspective, you approached me about acknowledging the International Day for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. And I wondered if you could share with us why this day is important to you. Why did you want to raise awareness about it?
Thank you for asking that very important question. The reason why I shared a bit of who I am and my story and the places that I have been. And I love the name of your podcast, Amazing Places, if I get it correct.
That's right.
Yeah. So places define us, who we are, and what we experience. So someone who've, crossed borders, seeked safe haven in certain countries. And it was very interesting because from my childhood to today, one thing I've learned is what governments allow for you to access and how government uphold your inherent right. And I think when we talk about racial discrimination, we're talking about inequality, we're talking about, the how othering of other people and how can we fight against racism and all form of discrimination. So all those places I've been, of course, I've faced racism and discrimination in different forms, you know, because I was migrant, I was refugee, you know, I didn't have so many rights. But now today I'm Canadian citizen and I'm also Canadian politician and working within the system. Also, I have the opportunity to talk about these things, but also see how do we try to make sure everyone has access to dignity, well-being, and quality of life, and have the opportunity to thrive. And when it comes to local communities, then we're speaking about how do we look at our systems and see creating inclusive, cohesive, and thriving communities, you know, where all members of the community have sense of belonging, feel safe, you know, and have quality at all stage of their lives so that they can thrive in things they pursued and so that they don't face any type of discrimination or othering. So that we see that the systems help us really recover from our traumatic experiences and dark history. Like now that we live in the Nkwankan speaking as people, Songhees and Squamal Nation, that we can also learn from the history, right? So at a local level is what can we do to really engage residents to understand how we can create more inclusive cities which really focus on the dignity and well-being of all residents.
And so what do you think are initiatives that could occur at the community level that would ensure that every resident in our community gets to enjoy that dignity, well-being, and quality of life?
That's very important question. I think no matter what we look, no matter where we live, who we are, or how much we have, you know, and first we have to make sure that we don't let anybody divide us, you know, and we've heard the sentiments about anti-immigrants, you know, and anti-Asian, anti-blackness. We've seen the increase of anti-Semitic, you know, and Islamophobia, homophobia, all forms of hate and racism. So we need to call out when we see prejudice and racism. I think we don't have to be bystanders. And when we call out, make sure you save. And there are workshops you could seek how to interfere when you see act of hate. But I think one thing we love, and you were a local leader and you're still local leader, once you were, you always are local leader, is that one thing I love about local government is that we're very close to the people, you know, is a government that is very visible what we do. Like if your garbage is not picked up, if the running water is not running, if the street lights are not working, if the pavement, sidewalks. So it's a very obvious and visible things in the local government. And that's why we're very close to people. So, and the neighbors, right, on a neighborhood level. So I think it starts being a better neighbor, you know, seeking to know who your neighbors are, you know, and trying to understand how they feel and checking in with them and trying to have a friend and other people and networks that don't have the experience you have, that might have different experience, right? I think that is a human level that is at the neighborhood level, but at the city level and the local level is we have to look into our systems and say, do the staff and the decision makers, do they have the tools to really understand when we make policy and decisions, how does it benefit everyone and all neighborhoods, you know, and how the public asset is welcoming, you know? I think at a city of Victoria, now we are implementing an equity framework, which would help us ask those questions like who benefits the public good, who's left behind. So we can invest in local government policies, then that means we invest in people, right? Which is very important, because when we take care of all of us, then we benefit all of us. And in particularly, how do we protect the most vulnerable, you know, which will definitely make us the most strong. And you know, we really better off when we are all offered the same dignity and access, opportunity, access to well-being, access to quality of life. But just to answer and end the question is, specifically that you ask it, what can the community do is try to understand other experiences and connect. Now we're in COVID-19, but when we are allowed to come together, is invite your neighbors to dinner. You know, everything happens on the kitchen table, and have this conversation with your family at the kitchen table.
I think it's so important. I totally agree with what you're saying, and human beings have an immense capacity for empathy, and that can be engaged with understanding and reaching out, but it requires us to make that initial step to get to know our neighbors, to have discussions with folks who are dissimilar to ourselves, who've had a lived experience that is quite different from that which we've had, and allow that interaction then allows us to benefit from a different perspective, mm-hmm. and appreciate the humanness of all of our experiences. Even though they are different, they were all informed by the same basic needs, and that we all mm-hmm. are seeking to thrive. We all want mm-hmm. what's best for our community, mm-hmm. and empathy and conversation allows us to recognize those commonalities. Mm-hmm. I wondered, one of the things that I've often struggled with as both an elected official and someone who does community engagement is the ability to reach those vulnerable populations. So in the process of, you know, the city of Victoria does an excellent job of consultation, as do a number of our communities in the region. Mm. And consultation is an effort to try and inform policy programs so that they meet the needs of all residents. Mm-hmm. But it's also extremely challenging to reach those vulnerable populations who often, I think, feel apprehensive about coming forward and you know, feeling exposed when trying to share their viewpoint. And there's a very real risk that they'll be met with derision when they do that. Mm. So how do communities make an effort to engage with those folks, to ensure that all perspectives are incorporated as part of the consultation process.
Yeah, it's really critical, right? And in every work we do, I think even today I am on this podcast because we had some sort of relationship. And even having this conversation, our trust and relationship would increase more. I think it begins with relationships, because I think in anything we do, especially when you trying to work with either vulnerable population or population that have a different experience, to understand or have the empathy, you have to really listen to them, to have the buy-in of that community of whatever you are trying to give or trying to convey. One is relationships are very crucial. Second is we need to empower the communities themselves. I tell you a story. When I was living in Cairo, when I finished university, you know, I was refugee. So the first job I got was an interpreter working with the NGOs. There was this amazing program. It's a psychosocial program, community psychosocial program. So what the director did was she took went to different refugee community, such as the Somalis, Ethiopian, Iraqis, Sudanese, and Congolese, and said, who are your community leaders? And then she trained them to become the community psychosocial workers, because they know the realities, they know the experience, they know the know-how and so many things. So I think it goes back to when we look at any city or any organization, we have to really think about empathy, right? And if all the staff have to have the empathy with the people in the community and the issues they face. So sometimes, you know, when we highly educated, which is excellent, and you know, when you want to become a city planner, the standards are very high in terms of educational and planning profession. If you work in the public works or if you work in the parks and recreation, to get the job, sometimes you need to have a certain privilege and profession. The profession selects for, sadly, sometimes people who have certain privilege because you had access to those educations. And having said that, and I got into trouble saying this, is that sometimes when you have that high level of privilege and access, then you miss out the certain lived experience of certain sector of the population, which would give you the window to have more empathy if you understand better the experience they have in. So that's why it's very crucial when we look at the whole workforce is to question, how does it represent the entire community when we make decisions and having systematic process that discriminate? So the more workforce we have, the more it means that community members sees themselves in those places, and hopefully would have more trust in City Hall, which will make it the work much easier. And I know it's a long answer, But it all goes back to the relationship and putting the resources and the capacity and the know-how at city level so that we can do meaningful work.
I want to take the opportunity to ask you about your experience. And I'm going to bring up the topic that I know has been one that you've heard and talked so much about over the last several months, and that was your international travel in at the end of 2020. And I know, having read an article about it in the Times Colonist, that when that was publicly acknowledged, when you acknowledged that that had taken place, and city council and the mayor had acknowledged it, that you received some very racially motivated, very aggressive responses to your statement, which I would suggest no other city councilor or elected official, likely in this region, would have been subjected to by nature of your skin color and your background. And I wondered if you could share a little bit about that experience, just so that for those of us who have never lived through that kind of experience would have an understanding of what folks would face potentially on a regular basis.
I love how you question, you ended. A lot of people experience this, you know, it's not only me. So, and there's so many people that face racism and discrimination and prejudices and all types of violence, but that don't have the privilege and opportunity to speak about it because of they're afraid of their livelihood, or they would be more in danger, or they don't want to make trouble sometimes, you know. But to give a context of what you've asked, I made a miscalculated poor decision and a mistake to travel when we finished the last council meeting in December, to make the choice to travel to Somalia for the first time since I left when I was 8, and to Kenya, where I have refugee families, you know, still. And that's the story of exile, you know, as indigenous communities will relate to it, because when you are uprooted, families are separated. So for me, I considered at that time my travel very essential, and just to support my family and, you know, many other reasons that I haven't talked about it. And I was afraid that, you know, because of the circumstances of the pandemic, which made it more difficult, that I wouldn't see some of them. So that was my initial thought when I was traveling, and, you know, we had a lot busier and I didn't think clearly. But when I came back in January 4th and then took all the steps, you know, stayed in Vancouver and isolated myself before I came, I took COVID. I did my best, all the precautions of recommended and beyond that, to make my community safe so that I didn't even come back to Vancouver Island. I know I have hurt it and let people down and through that choice I made, and I made an apology, you know, long statement I made to council and social media. I spoke to Gregor on CBC and Global News, and I took full responsibility, because I knew that so many of the residents and my constituencies were feeling so much pain, because a lot of them couldn't see their loved ones, and a lot of them was living considerable hardship and were vulnerable to COVID-19. Because of that, I really took ownership of my mistake and said, absolutely, people could get angry at me, you know, because I made a choice that many people didn't make. And absolutely, politicians should be held to higher standards because I held to my higher standards. A lot of people, of course, you know, were feeling pain, so they had to channel that pain at a place. So I accepted it. And today is like we in March, and that is January 4th. Then there was this wave of hate that I have received, you know, and calling me the N-word, literally receiving phone calls telling me we're gonna come to your house and drag you, you know, and come to your office and feather you, you know, all these slurs and racial charge that some of them were heard in the slavery time, you know. You would think that those things you wouldn't believe are some residents of Victoria, you know. But I'm reminded again, they are not the majority of Victoria, you know. The majority of Victoria are the ones who elected me, the ones who believed in me and put me in the position that I will work for the collective of the well-being of us. So I continuously received a lot of hate. And until now, you know, like until I'm speaking to you, what was more unfortunate was some local radios, the way they treated my story, calling me, and a lot of people calling me a liar, and saying, oh, he went to East Africa, to Djibouti and Ethiopia 2019, and why didn't he go to Somalia, you know? And really that was really, I tried to understand where people coming from, but it was a bit strange because one thing is I'm Canadian politician and Somalia is not a country that you can just show up. You know, if you were like next border, you can't just go, you know. It's a very conflict area, instability, high insecurity. You know, I am a high profile because I'm Canadian politician, you know. So it needs really careful and deliberate planning on my part. Then I was able to take under those years that I might happen to be in countries nearby, which were safe and those countries. So then it goes back to what we were talking about earlier. If people don't understand the unique experiences of where you're coming from, what is the political, historical issues in Somalia, then people and hate you for no reason. If people are unhappy because I made certain political choices, then I welcome that. You know, criticism is healthy in democracy, but to target your race, your religion, who you are, and threaten you to come to your house and to come to your office and tear you like a feather, I think that is unacceptable. And today, as we're talking about the day of racial discrimination, it's a reminder that we need to really eliminate all racial discrimination.
Thank you so much for sharing that, Shamarke. And it really reinforces that there's so much work for us to do. You know, I think for a lot of us, we would feel like, oh, that would never happen in Victoria or in the capital region. But your experience demonstrates that these attitudes exist and that there's lots of work for all of us to do to call that out and to be more cognizant about our work in acknowledging the lived experience that people have, that the varied backgrounds and experiences that contribute to the dynamic social fabric of our community, and reinforcing that that's valued, and that discrimination against those perspectives and those individuals is not tolerated, and that our institutions make an effort to ensure that those voices are heard and that they're represented, and that this community is one that is dedicated to inclusion, and that everyone has the ability to seek and thrive and pursue those foundational elements of dignity, well-being, and quality of life. So I really appreciate you sharing what obviously was a very hurtful experience, because I think it's so helpful for us to be exposed to that and realize that, you know, despite maybe our preconceptions about what this community is all about, that some of these attitudes continue to exist and that we all have work to do yet.
Yeah, and thank you for saying that. And absolutely, we have work to do. And when people distract you, racism and you know, all the emails you receive, all the messages, then it kind of like is very exhausting, you know. Like I shared this quote which Toni Morrison said, you know, the very serious faction of racism is a distraction. It keeps you from doing your work. It keeps you explaining over and over again your reason for being. And I think that says to me a lot, you know, and I understand for a lot of people, I don't expect a lot of people to get every experience, because I myself learning a lot. Like before I came to Canada, I knew little about trans inclusion and things like that. So I had to take workshops, make friends who identify as a trans community, get to know them, and try to understand, build those relationships. When I built those relationships, it really made me understand more than what I was reading from an article, from a book, and things like that. So I think relationships is really important. And when it comes to government, you know, like when we talk about COVID-19, what we need, then we need to see all our policies from, you know, like from caring for those who are homeless, to supporting immigrants, to protecting essential workers, to making our schools safe, to, you know, childcare, to protecting renters, and to, you know, like accessible and medical and all that, then ask how do we make free out of racism from all those programs and support, so that everyone could access and people could feel safe in those places. And just to you know, like when Black Lives Matter happened, you know, and I remember I tweeted, I was just looking for the tweet, that people saying, you know, all lives matter. Yes, all lives matter, you know. And people say that, because we're talking about youth, the theme you said, youth, when the youth went to even in Victoria and talked about Black Lives Matter, a lot of people say, I don't see color, you know. And I went to I shared my perspective on that on social media, and people could follow me on Twitter if they want to see that, is that I wanted to emphasize that Black Lives Matter is not a term of confrontation, but rather an opportunity to reflect on the historical and contemporary realities of Black people in this country. And Vancouver Island and BC, we have a long history of Black people, you know, which I'm still learning and fascinates me. So someone who was a former refugee who came here, you know, I'm a benefactor of the freedom movement that paved the way for equitable treatment in this country and in our community for a long time. So I think when we talk about it is, and when I use my platform and voice, even choosing now to talk about this, is all the programs, affordable housing, everything we do, if we don't look deeply, if it is free out of discrimination, and what data are we using, who are we serving, then it's very important to really understand and how our programs work. Because now, more than ever in COVID-19, it showed and highlighted and the disproportionately which communities are impacted more, the inequalities, the economic gap, the income gap, you know, how the multi-billionaires getting richer and the normal everyday people are left out. So government need to do policies that serve everyday people, you know. On the top of that, then we need data, you know, because it will tell us where are the gaps, you know, it will make us make helpful public policy decisions. But on the flip side, lack of data and lack of understanding what the problem is can lead us to lack of essential public health action or lack of essential of meaningful action. So even your early question, how to help vulnerable population, is having the accurate data and understanding the population so that we could see where the gaps are, because when without proper data, we cannot see the full problem or see why some people are more likely to be affected than others, you know? So that is the important work. And baby steps, you know, it takes a generation for change, but we can slowly start step by step. First, identifying the problem, then acknowledging, saying that earlier you said, when we see it, we need to call it out. Then we need to move from that. We know what the problem is. Then how do we identify the problem? And do we have the correct evidence and data? Then what resources are needed and where do we put the resources? It's not taken away from one group to give another group. Sometimes the sad reality is that it's framed pitting one vulnerable group against another vulnerable group. And that is a very dangerous, as you know.
March 21st is the International Day for the Elimination of Racial Discrimination. Charmarque Dubot is a first-term Victoria City Councillor. Charmarque, thank you so much for taking the time to share your experience and for raising the significance of this issue, for both what it means to you and what it can mean for our community. I so appreciate having the time to talk with you today.
Thank you for having me, and I'm blessed and grateful to be this amazing place called Vancouver Island. We're so lucky, you know. Thank you for having me.
This has been another episode of Amazing Places. I'm Dean Murdoch. Thanks for listening.